This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, the government of Tonga backs away from reintroducing the death penalty for serious drug offences. Frustrated villagers on Manus Island crowdfund their own road repairs after 30 years of neglect by local authorities. And the countdown begins for PNG's cricketers ahead of their debut in the men's T20 World Cup Finals series. Those stories to come. First, the Fijian government's no jab, no job policy is facing a high court challenge. Since July, anyone working in the public or private sector must be vaccinated against COVID-19 or face dismissal. And as Mackenzie Smith reports, a small number have lost their jobs. But the lawyer steering the legal challenge says as major vaccine suppliers, both Australia and New Zealand should bear some of the responsibility.
Elena Lawena is a physiotherapist and worked at Fiji's Ministry of Health for more than two decades until she was fired last month. The widower has five dependent children and is devastated by the termination.
It has affected me in every way, I can say, emotionally, even physically, in the sense that emotionally, I love to do my job. I've been doing this for the past 24 years. I went to medical school because I wanted to be a physiotherapist. And serving the public is my passion.
She's one of a small group in Fiji who haven't had their first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. At least 95% of those who are eligible have done so, while 47% have both doses. But the no jab, no job policy leaves Miss Lawena and potentially tens of thousands of others in limbo. But she says despite her family's financial precarity, her mind is made up.
Whatever happens after this, I depend on my God that will provide for me, provide for my children's welfare. I will do some work to support my kids financially. But then I can say honestly that I miss my work.
Market vendors are also affected. The Fiji Times newspaper reported that around 1,600 unvaccinated vendors were refused entry to markets last month. Some are outraged by the situation and are taking legal action. Human rights lawyer Aman Ravindra Singh has filed a challenge to the no jab, no job policy at the Lautoka High Court on behalf of five litigants. Mr. Singh, who has his first dose of the vaccine, says without informed consent, the policy breaches Fiji's constitution.
The challenge is not the drug or the vaccine. We are not challenging the sciences. While the narrative has changed and what people were made to believe initially has obviously turned around a few times and things are different. But the bottom line is you cannot force vaccination, and to discriminate our people on the very basis that if you do not take the jab, you will lose your job. For an employer, if you have not taken the jab, then your business will be shut. That is not acceptable.
Fiji Minor Workers and Staff Union President Ali Fereti Kaukau is one of the plaintiffs. He says 40 mining employees in Suva were laid off because they refused the vaccine, and he's hoping the case will win them back their jobs.
They got every right and decision to go for the job. Like I said, the law that they just... It's being passed by the government. It breaches the clause on that constitution.
But the Fiji government is set on its mass vaccination campaign while the virus still spreads uncontrolled. There have been more than 46,000 cases confirmed and 800 COVID-19 related deaths since the outbreak began in April. Lawyer Aman Ravindra Singh says people were given the impression they would be safe after the first dose of the vaccine rather than two doses. Meanwhile, he says more people are losing work every day.
In a proper democracy, this would be unacceptable. I'm sure we all agree on that, but not out here. So what good is the supreme law of the land if the government who brought about that document into force cannot even respect their own constitution?
Legally mandated vaccines aren't unheard of in the Pacific. Parts of Australia and New Zealand require some frontline workers, like those at airports and in aged care facilities, to be vaccinated. And in the Solomon Islands, public servants had to get their first dose of the vaccine by the start of this month or be locked out of their work. But by targeting the entire private sector, Fiji has gone far beyond any of its neighbours. And Mr. Singh believes that as suppliers of most of Fiji's AstraZeneca vaccines, Australia and New Zealand bear some responsibility too for locking Fijians out of work.
I lay the blame squarely on the shoulders of Australia and New Zealand, and I put forward that Australia and New Zealand have a moral obligation to the people of Fiji to confront the Fiji government and to say you need to stop this.
A High Court hearing for the case is set for September the 17th.
That report from Mackenzie Smith. Meanwhile, employers in Papua New Guinea are facing mounting pushback after they tried to introduce the same no jab, no job vaccination strategy. At one prominent business, angry workers stoned the chief executive's car in protest. The response among other companies has been less violent, but the resistance to vaccination is widespread. And right now, as Liam Fox reports, fewer than 2% of the adult population in PNG have been fully immunised.
In Lae, PNG's industrial and manufacturing heartland, Adrian Chow says it's been difficult convincing all of his workers to get vaccinated against COVID-19.
They think that once you get vaccinated, there's electricity running through your body, or they think that within a few months or a year or so, you might die. It's very difficult to change their attitudes because, it's something new. This disease has happened so quickly, so suddenly.
He's the managing director of Prima Small Goods and oversees 300 workers processing pork and beef products. Prima's decided vaccinations are now mandatory for casual workers and new employees, but it's only recommending permanent staff get immunised. Last Friday, a local nurse was invited to talk to staff about the virus and vaccines. Mr. Chow says it did not go well.
It got a bit out of hand towards the end when some of the staff with strong views against vaccination started shouting her down. They became quite rude and disrespectful.
It wasn't pretty, but it was not as bad as the situation at Mainland Holdings, another big Lae-based business. According to local reports, on Monday, the CEO's car was stoned by a group of staff who were angry at the company's strict new no-jab, no-job policy. Mainland Holdings has declined to comment, but a look at PNG's vaccination rate shows why businesses are eager to immunise their workers. Only 1.7% of the eligible population is fully vaccinated. That's just over 32,000 people in a country with a total population of nearly 9 million. The Deputy Pandemic Controller, Dr. Downey Esserom, admits that's not good enough, and vaccine hesitancy is still a major problem.
The number is very low. We need to work very hard to convince people, to educate them, to understand the benefits of vaccines, the side effects, what vaccine could do in terms of protecting themselves, their families, and also the communities.
PNG is lagging far behind other Pacific countries in the immunisation drive, and it's not because of a lack of doses. Unlike its neighbours, Fiji and Solomon Islands, PNG has not made vaccinations mandatory for certain segments of the population, like public and private sector workers. In PNG, they're optional for everyone. But Dr. Esserom says the government supports the right of employers to mandate vaccinations in their workplaces.
Why? You have no right to infect other people. It's essentially, for us now, it's becoming an occupational and health safety issue in the workplace. So we need to protect the workplace. But for businesses, it's much more urgent because it affects the bottom line.
Back in Lae, Adrian Chow says authorities need to provide more information to make clear the threat COVID-19 poses.
Give more information on, say, what are the actual case numbers coming through in the hospital, and perhaps present a balanced and true picture of what actually is happening in Papua New Guinea. When there's a lack of information, it tends to be put at the back of the mind. It's not happening now. So this is why people just go back to their normal way before COVID.
That's Adrian Chow, Managing Director of Prima Small Goods in PNG's second city, Lae, and the reporter there was Liam Fox. The government of Tonga has backed away from a push to reintroduce the death penalty as part of a crackdown on drug traffickers in the face of pressure from regional neighbours Australia and New Zealand. The parliamentary speaker, Lord Whakapuanui, tabled a bill in support of capital punishment, but when it came to the vote, MPs opted to support life sentences for the worst offenders instead. Tonga's Justice Minister, Samiu Vaipulu, says he was particularly unhappy about his noble colleague's proposal.
I was the first to object to the whole idea because I wanted to see government doing everything it can before introducing capital punishment.
The speaker who proposed those changes had suggested the stronger penalties to deal with the drug abuse in Tonga, saying that it impacted on Tonga society quite massively. Child labour paid with drugs, a rise in crime and broken families. Is that the picture that you are seeing in Tonga at the moment?
Yes, but I also see that we have not done all we can before we impose capital punishment.
And what is it that you want to see done to address these issues?
We need to rehab these people and start teaching the kids when they are still young to go against drugs, but we haven't done that.
Do colleagues within the parliament share your views about needing to put resources and money towards rehabilitation?
Yes, we are concentrating on setting up plans to fight all these drugs.
And what would those plans include?
Well, in prisons, we've increased our capacity and we have a special division to take care of drugs. And we are trying to think of a way of getting these people rehabilitated so that when they come out, they can do something better instead of drugs.
A lot of the key players in sort of sourcing the drugs that do end up in Tonga come from overseas. Will punishing people within Tonga who commit drug offences actually address the wider issue and the source of the drugs?
I think, yes, it should. It should address that.
Minister, ahead of the parliamentary debate on whether to introduce the death penalty, were you approached by foreign diplomats, including Australia's High Commissioner?
Yes, they did. The New Zealand, Australian and British, they gave me their concerns and we shared what we can do and we are looking forward that we will work together with them.
And what sort of assistance will they be providing?
It's all this rehab and more education towards kids and several other things like deportees, because most of the problems now, it's deportees. So we ask them if we have some deportees from overseas, have them rehabilitated in Australia and New Zealand before ever sending them here to Tonga. But right now, New Zealand and Australia and even the United States, when they have people with problems, they flood them over here to our islands without doing anything about them. And they come here and do the same thing here.
And what was the response from Australia, New Zealand to that proposal of potentially rehabilitating people who are already in Australia before they go back to Tonga?
The response was quite promising. We are looking forward to start talking on that and seeing how best we can tackle all these problems.
And what are the next steps for you in Tonga off the back of this, moving forward in tackling this issue?
Yes, we have increased the budget on drugs, fighting drugs already. And we think it's promising that we can get this done within some few years from now. We are trying our best.
That's Tonga's Minister for Justice, Samiu Vaipulu. He was talking to Jordan Fennell. I'm Richard Ewart, and you're listening to Pacific Review. The road between the villages of Buyong and Kari on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea is a vital link with the provincial capital, Loringal. However, after 3 decades of neglect, that link was bust. The situation was creating havoc and there were tragic consequences. But then an ad hoc committee was formed and the frustrated villagers were helped to help themselves by using money from a crowdfunding campaign managed by Andrew Noho to get the road fixed.
It reads where we come from more than 30 years ago and up to now, there's no maintenance. And it's ignorance by the provincial government and the national government. In fact, the highway itself is a national road. But ignorance, and I think politics involved as well. And I didn't realize that we would come to the extent of coming to the media, because to us, it's about helping the unfortunate in the village level, because they walk for hours, even up to half a day, just walking. Villages that are in the village, they just can't come to town because they just don't want to walk. There's no development in families. Even our school system has dropped because of this problem. Government services can't reach the village because there's no road in a condition where we can freely move in and out.
So if you want a job done well, or in this case at all, do it yourself, was the mantra adopted by Antonia when she and four other former Manus villagers now living and working in Moresby formed a steering committee and pledged to get the road mended. Another of the five committee members is Jerry Cowan, who says the work was vital because the state of the road has cost lives.
A number of our sick and the mothers in labor, they have died along the way because of this this situation. And that was the whole reason why we had to step in to try and assist where we can to at least get those deteriorated sections of the road passable so that they can have access to those services.
So the committee set themselves a very modest funding target of 5,000 kina, 1,000 for each of the five villages in all whose communities were blighted by the broken road.
We came together, I think, in July with the view to organize people at home and have them do something for themselves rather than waiting on the government. So there are five villages in the area that we live. So we came up with the idea that to kickstart the fundraising, we have to come up with a target. And then that will be the initiative to present to the people in the village to do something for themselves. But we will give them the support and the backup.
Some of the money came in big chunks, 1,000 kina, for example, from a judge to support his home village, while the villagers themselves contributed what they could.
Using social media, we communicated on Facebook, and then we had interested people who then donated. So we have a number of people who donated as individuals. Two people that came with 1,000 kina representing their village. And then with the other three villages, we had small contributions that came in. So initially, we raised 5,500.
In the end, they went well beyond their target and collected 7,000 kina, equivalent to less than 3,000 Australian dollars. Work on making the road passable began, and Jerry Cowan says life in the villages should be very different now.
It's going to be simpler for them now. They needed services in terms of schools, education and health services, especially transporting materials to the doorsteps. And also for the SMEs, for our local subsistence farmers to bring their produce to the markets and also to have access to the government services that are in town.
Antonio Noho says Jerry was so dedicated to the cause, he contributed money from his own pocket to cover the cost of transport to get the road materials to the work site. But the question anyone will be justified in asking is, why did the villagers have to fix their own road in the first place? The best answer right now would seem to be because they were totally frustrated.
Leaders in the village, they approached local authorities, the provincial government level and the works department, who are supposed to be responsible for this section of the road, but there seem to be no favourable answers.
There is an election looming in Papua New Guinea next year, and the Road Fix Committee have come under fire from critics who suggest the whole thing was a big political stunt, a claim that is flatly denied by both Jerry Cowan and Antonia Noho.
It's not politically driven or anything. It's just humanitarian for the villages that are struggling very badly there in Manus.
There were some comments I saw on Facebook and, you know, the social media that a lot of people were thinking that the work that we're doing is associated to politics and all this because general election is just next year. And I keep telling them that the activities and the initiatives that we have taken has nothing to do with politics.
Jerry Cowan, one of the five committee members who brought that road project on Manus Island together. Finally, the Barramundis, Papua New Guinea's men's cricket team, are a little over a month away from playing their first ever match in a T20 World Cup Finals series. And the countdown has begun, with the PNG squad having already touched down in Oman, one of the joint hosts, who will actually be the Pacific Island team's first opponents on October the 17th. Between now and then, the Barras will play a series of warm-up games, starting with the USA on Monday. The squad and their new coach, the Australian-born former Italian international Carl Sandri, have come face-to-face for the first time in the Gulf. And having come through all the necessary COVID-19 protocols, the captain, Asad Vala, says they can't wait to get started.
We got tested at the airport, then they gave us 24 hours, so we got isolation in the room. Once the results came back negative, then we got out. Cricket PNG have done a really good job. Greg and his staff put us in a really good resort, you know, to go out and do some work outside of their rooms. And we got a really good place to hang out also. But main thing is we are here to work. We got a really good gym there. We got some grass here. So we're doing some simple stuff like mobility and strength work at the gym with the time difference and all those stuff. We're just trying to get used to their time and waking up on time and all those stuff.
So tell me, how long is it since the Barramundis last played in international games?
It's been 2 years now. Since we qualified for the World Cup, this is the first time we've toured again.
Originally, of course, you were coming to Australia to play in the World Cup, and that didn't happen. Then you were going to India to play in the World Cup, and then that didn't happen. Now you're in Oman, which will co-host the World Cup. I'm thinking maybe this might work out quite well for you, because you played a lot of cricket in that part of the world.
We did in Dubai, but this is the first time we're going to play cricket in Oman. We're still getting some information. We got a really good coach in Carl, who's digging up some information on the wickets and how we can put up a plan to counter everyone when we come up against in Oman.
Quite a big job, though, that the new coach has taken on, because you got used to Joe Dawes being your coach, and he was the one who got you through to the World Cup finals. And then COVID came along, Joe moved on to other things. So it's quite a task, I would have thought, for Carl, your new coach, to maintain the momentum against that background. Would you agree?
He's been really good. He's doing a really great job for us. He's been spot on with everything he's been doing. The boys love him. This is the first time we have met him face to face, so we're still getting to know him at the moment.
He's very familiar with the associate world, isn't he? He played for Italy.
Italy, and we played against him. A few of the boys played against him. He mentioned it. So he's got a vote over some of the boys. He got the boys out in one of the games. So he's been chirping it about that since we arrived.
You're going to be away from home for around about 8 weeks. You've got warm-up games coming. Then you have World Cricket League 2 games to play. And then finally, the big one, the T20 World Cup. 8 weeks is a long time, but I assume you're focused so much on the World Cup that that's going to be what will get you through this chance that you've been waiting for so many years.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming. We thought, is it going to happen that the Barras are going to ever go to a World Cup, or are we going to go to a qualification again? But lucky enough, it was confirmed that the co-host would be Oman and UAE. But like you said, 8 weeks is a long time, but the boys have done it before, but in different situations. The world we are living in is a bit different to what we used to do before. This is the first tour we have done in probably 2 years since we qualified for the World Cup. So the boys are really looking forward to the opportunity. Lucky enough, we're going to play some lead-up matches and a 50 over before we get into the World Cup.
If I'm correct, you're going to play Scotland in a warm-up game, you're going to play Scotland in a 50-over game, and then you'll play them in the T20 World Cup. So you'll know a thing or two about each other when it comes down to the big one.
We've played a few times over the years in 50-over matches and T20, so we're looking forward to this. It's a really good challenge playing against a really good cricketing nation.
How much belief is there in the PNG team that you can get through this qualifying group alongside Oman, Scotland and Bangladesh?
We have confidence in our own abilities, and I think we work really hard for this opportunity and just can't wait to get on the field and, you know, give our best. A big aim is get into the second round, and that's what we really hope.
And what about for you personally? You've been playing for Papua New Guinea for a long time now. Some major achievements for you over the years. You've been recognised in select teams and the like. But I guess this is going to be the biggest thing that's ever happened to you in cricket, isn't it?
Definitely. This is a pinnacle. When we had a team talk before, we're setting up goals and all those stuff, team goals and individual goals. Everyone in the team always mentioned that it's a dream for every individual in the PNG Barramundis to play in the World Cup. And it's just around the corner. I can't wait to play in the World Cup and test myself against the best.
And you did, a couple of years back, spend a year in Brisbane with the T20 franchise there and in the Australian Big Bash, but you didn't get an opportunity to play. But if you go out there in the T20 World Cup and do what you can do, which is score runs and take handy wickets as well, do you think you might finally get your chance in the Big Bash or maybe in New Zealand's competition?
Hopefully. That's why the World Cup and all these big tournaments are really important, not just for the teams, but in individual players as well. You can put in a good performance, you might catch the eye of someone to give you an opportunity to play in the 2020 league.
And more broadly for cricket in Papua New Guinea, maybe this could be a turning point.
I think so. There's been really good backing back home with the support from the government and everyone. So hopefully we can put in the performance and get more backing from the government and everyone back home and support, because rugby league is big in PNG, but it is getting where we want it to be.
Asad Vala, captain of the Papua New Guinea men's cricket team, on the line from Oman and rounding out this edition of Pacific Review. I'm Richard Ewart, and as always, thank you very much for listening.